So they say I will be one until my dying day. Everything's a fight, a world of fuss. Let your guard down, you turn to rust. Because it's so much bitter when you know.
Gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. From senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. The mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing. It is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
Okay, we all know who that cat was. That was Bob Dylan, The Times They Are A-Changin'. Before that was a tune from my own project called Spaghetti Eastern Music. That's a tune called Time for Letting Go from an album called Sketches of Spam. You are listening to WGXC 90.7 Accra, the Wave Farm. It's radio for open ears, and we're here for the latest monthly installment of a show called Reading is Funkdamental. Not fundamental, funkdamental. Yes. It's a monthly show. It's a podcast about books, about music. Often we've had guests, including musicians who've written memoirs. We recently had Robin Hitchcock and Phil Manzanera from Roxy Music, Dave Mason from Traffic, and we have a lot of great authors, including the gentleman we are going to be speaking to today named David Brown. First off, my name is Sal Cataldi. I am a local musician and also a writer. I write book reviews, obviously, music reviews and features for the New York Times, Pop Matters, Rolling Stone, New York State Music, Inside Out, Upstate New York, and I'm also a musician. You might have heard I have a band called Spaghetti Eastern Music, Guitars A-Go-Go, Vapor Vespers, and Space Heater. But enough about me. Okay. So we're here with David Brown. He's a veteran music journalist who has expertly chronicled the community of Greenwich Village in a fantastic new book called Talking Greenwich Village. It's on a lot of the best of lists for 2024. I did a review of it for Pop Matters, and I I put it in the best books of 24 because it deserves it. He's really well equipped to take this on. He writes for Rolling Stone. He's presently a senior writer there, but he's authored biographies of a host of musicians, including Sonic Youth, Tim and Jeff Buckley, The Grateful Dead, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And he lived in New York, so he witnessed a lot of the changes. This book really deals with everything, sort of from the 50s folk jamborees through the jazz and rock revolutions of the 60s to punk in the 70s and the all-too-brief revival of folk music in the 1980s. He based this book on 150 interviews with notables who were part of the scene, like Judy Collins, John Sebastian, Sonny Rollins, Herbie Hancock, Suzanne Vega, the Roach Sisters. This is a real epic book, and it is an epic conversation. So stick around, and let's hear from David Brown all about Greenwich Village. Okay, we are here with David Brown, who has written a fantastic book all about the history of Greenwich Village, mainly on the music scene, but some culture too. David, let's hear a little bit about your background first. You've been writing about music for a long time. You've done a number of books, so let's start there.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's great to be here, Sal. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm a fan of the podcast, so it's an honor to be here among some of those other writers.
Yes.
And musicians you've had on. Yes, I've been doing this for a long time. The roots of this book actually probably started when I was a journalism student at NYU many, many decades ago and wrote for one of the student papers at NYU. So covering, some of that was covering that scene in the village back in the 80s. And yeah, since then I worked at a now defunct but excellent music magazine in the 80s called Music and Sound Output. It was based on Long Island, and went from there to the Daily News in New York, was a reporter there. And then I spent 16 years as the music critic at Entertainment Weekly, and which was a really fun ride. And then I've been with Rolling Stone as either a contributing editor or now a staff senior writer since 2008. So and actually, yes, I forgot to say, I did write record reviews in my high school newspaper in Clifton, New Jersey. And I remember writing a really, really bad review of an album by Rod Stewart, who I liked, called Footloose and Fancy Free. And I remember overhearing some of my classmates in the hallway by their lockers debating my review. One was like, that's a great album. The other was, no, he's right. That sucks. So I've been doing this for a while for various things.
Yeah, and I remember, I know you sort of peripherally from my prior career was I did publicity. So until about, 2 years ago, for 30 years, I had my own PR agent. So we were dealing with each other in another capacity. But now I'm on your side of the fence, which is the fun side of the fence.
Welcome aboard.
Well, it's a tough life. So let's talk about the book. Let's talk about the process of writing the book. Obviously, you said you did witness a lot of this stuff because you mentioned in the book that you, were a student at NYU. I'm assuming before that you were taking the train in and going and seeing shows. So let's talk about that and what got you so fascinated about it and the whole process of interviewing 150 people for this book.
Sure. In some ways, the seeds of the book were planted back then at NYU, which was, I was there from the late 70s and early 80s. And, there was no question the 60s were over. There was a certain pall that was cast over the village and the music scene. Some of the venues were still there, but, many of the great artists were gone. But there was, there was a whole new world starting up in that time. We had newer clubs the Folk City was still there, Bitter End, the Village Gate, those were all still up and running. You had a new place called Kenny's Castaways. Mm-hmm. I remember walking right past it on my first night at college, and my roommates and I walked around the village, and you could hear music coming out of all these places. And pretty soon it became clear that there was a new generation coming up at that moment. You had Steve Forbert's first album that fall, right when I went to college. The Roaches were about to release their first record. Within a couple of years, you had people like Suzanne Vega and Sean Colvin. There was a new club that opened called the Speakeasy. There were new jazz artists in the West Village, like David Murray. So, right away, I had this sense that the scene didn't die in 1966, that it had its ups and downs, and it had gone through some rough times, but it was starting to come alive again. I remember seeing the Smithereens when they were like a bar band on Bleecker Street. You know, even then I
Yeah.
was like, oh, there's a new rock band in the village. So in a way, I've had this idea in my mind for a long time in some regards. And I think about, geez, five years ago, right before the pandemic, I remember doing a story for Rolling Stone on Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
Right.
And we met in the village at the Bitter End, and then he was in town for a show, and we just did a little walking tour of the village, you know, just to, as part of my reporting, and you know, it jogged all these memories for him. You know, he remember the Bitter End is where the Rolling Thunder Review started in 1975.
Right.
He remembered being there and hanging out with Dylan, and Dylan
Right.
giving him a glass of wine. Hey, you want to go on the road with this thing? We walked by what used to be the Gaslight Cafe, a legendary basement club where Dylan and many others started, which is now a restaurant.
What it
So
became was that the place that became the scrap bar?
I think you're right. I
I
don't
think
think
it
it's
was.
that far
It, that
anymore.
was
Yes.
no, but it was briefly. It was a metal bar and it had the weirdest PA system I ever played through. It was like 100 tiny like radio speakers because they were very concerned about sound. So the drum set went through it, everything went through it, and it was
Okay.
horrible, but it was a
That
club.
that's
But at any
funny.
rate, I'm gonna
It's
distract.
funny they were still concerned about sound because, you know, the part of the legend of the Gaslight Cafe is that's where finger snapping started, because it
Right.
was in the basement of this tenement building and there was a coal chute that ran into the basement, and any sounds in the basement, like people clapping, would go right up the chute into all the apartments, and people complained, and that's when, for a period there, they switched. They told people in the audience to, you know, snap your fingers and not clap. And so that was
It's
the
still
sound was an issue even in 1961.
and it still perpetuates to this day. So again, the book, it largely really kicks off. I mean, you have some really fascinating prehistory in there about the sort of lesbian tea house scene and the drag clubs and all that earlier village. But really the through line in this book is Dave Enronk.
It
Who,
is.
if you could tell us a little bit about Dave, he's fat. I have to thank you for your book because I was vaguely aware of him, and but I really sort of started to do some deep listening after reading your book, and I'm all the more happy for it. So tell us about Dave and the role he played really in this whole
Sure.
folklore.
Sure. In the early stages of the book, I knew that there were certain, you know, people I had to chronicle and include, and not just Dylan, that there were many others along the lines. And Dave was someone who I knew was going to play a major role in the book in some regard, because he was there when the scene was starting up in the late 50s. He never left the village until, you know, until his death in 2002. Unlike Dylan and many others who came and went, he stayed there the whole time. He was kind of the bedrock of the scene. And I learned that more and more as I talked to people and found out that the wide range of people took guitar lessons from him, you know, which started in the late 50s. You know, most of the Blues Project, you know, the Roach Sisters, you know, on and on. Dave was, even though he wasn't that old in the early 60s, he was still this sort of towering figure. He represented a certain uncompromising kind of integrity that they looked up to. The way that he blended, he hated being called a folk singer. So he you know, because he loved folk, but he loved blues and he loved jazz and, you know, all kinds of things. So that melding of styles was very village. So you know, I remember seeing him once at the Speakeasy, which was the folk club in the back of the falafel restaurant in McDougal Street in the 80s, and just seeing him once, like hanging out at the bar there. And I was a college kid, I was completely intimidated. I couldn't even go over to
Yeah, it
talk,
was
but it was
kind of
cool to
a
actually see him there. But you know, but so I knew he was going to be a major character. And then, you know, the more I saw the way that he, the connections he had to the scene, how his own life and career paralleled aspects of the scene. You know,
Right.
he was there when it started, and there were very few coffee houses. He was there when the coffee house explosion started by 1960, and you had dozens of them. He was there when Dylan showed up. He was there when the scene, you know, went electric, and he had his own rock band. He was there in the, you know, in the 70s when the scene had a downturn, and he was struggling too. And he was there in the early 80s, like, you know, as I just said, kind of cheering on the next generation. So, you know, in a way, I took some inspiration from the book. from Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, which is a wonderful book about the Black migration from the South to the North. Highly recommended book. And one of the things that she, the way she told that story was focusing on several different families and characters and tracing their journeys almost parallel. And I remember being somewhat, I mean, I love the book and thinking, which I happened to read that book right before I started working on mine. And I remember thinking, oh, what if there's some way I could do something like that? Because I felt like I wanted to humanize the story of the village. I didn't want it to be just a list of clubs that opened and closed. I wanted people to see the scene through the eyes of certain recurring characters who embodied it. And Dave, you know, absolutely embodied so many things about it that I realized after a while, like having him as a through line would sort of connect it all, and I could have things happening around him while we see him go through his life.
Right. And like many things, it was an incredibly small scene in the beginning, correct? I mean, it really started talking about the folk scene. It started around the I guess around the folklore center and the gaslight and the kettle of fish. And so let's talk a little bit about Dylan and sort of the impact he had on the scene and sort of to some degree the backlash against him on some level kind of mirrors what sort of happened, you'd say later in the book, in terms of Suzanne Vega's sort of getting this, mass media popularity. But let's talk about Dylan, his arrival and.
His Dylan's timing was just so kind of perfect in a way when you think about it. And one of the things that I did early on in the book, just to add, is that I created a Word doc and just would put in every date and every notable date or notable show or when a club opened or closed. And that's partly why also I structured the book. And by the time he arrived in early 61, thanks to my timeline and research and whatnot, I mean, it was pretty clear the scene was already kind of in place. You know, you had by then you had the Gaslight Cafe opening music featuring music, not just poets. Gertie's Folk City had just switched over to music less than a year later. You had more basket houses and more coffee houses opening. You know, people like Judy Collins and Tom Paxton were already in town. You know, it was all kind of coming together. But you know, you are reminded of what a well, first of all, about Dylan, how quickly it all happened. I mean, the cliche of Dylan is that everyone heard him for the first time and thought, oh God, you know, listen to that voice, and like he's not writing his own songs, and like he just stood apart so much. He brought that kind of rock and roll sensibility in a way into the scene, and he and that's one of many ways that he was basically he was built a disruptor. You know, there was this scene all in place, like I said, and you had people like Jack Holtzman at Elektra and so forth, kind of, you know, sniffing around, like, who am I going to sign from this scene? And it was. I wouldn't call it a genteel scene, but there was a camaraderie happening. And like Dylan just arrives, and you know, we forget how quickly it all happened for him. He arrives there in January. By the fall, he's got a record deal with Columbia Records, and everyone's like, what the heck? You know,
Well,
it's
it's really interesting, you being a writer and me just sort of starting now again. I used to do it in the old days. The impact that like Robert Shelton had, like it was sort of the old days where, you get a review in the New York Times and everybody comes running, where I don't think it works that way anymore. I mean, I think it's like they look at your Instagram numbers and then that
Right.
might determine
Exactly.
it and how well you But you were talking about Dylan, and again, he really did kind of the scene revolved around him. The Kettle of Fish, tell us a little about that. That was kind of the
Yeah.
big hangout where everyone.
The Kettle of Fish was a restaurant. It's still there, although a different name, right above the Gaslight Cafe. And it was this, you know, this the Italian restaurant slash bar where everybody would just kind of congregate. Especially since it was right above the Gaslight, so you could hang out there before a show or after, and it became in some ways the non-music focus of the scene, just as much as the Folklore Center by Izzy Young, which was right a couple doors down. You know, you forget how also how close everything was back then. It was amazing. Made one of the things that made the village scene so vital. It's not like LA, we have to drive from one club to another. You could cross the street and there was another place and so forth. And the Kettle
And
was,
everyone could afford
what?
to live. Everyone could afford to live in the neighborhood at that time, right? They weren't driving.
That's true. Yes,
Yeah.
yes. You know, talking to people who lived there at the time and hearing, oh yeah, I paid $50 a month rent, or it kind of boggles the mind. But yeah, the Kettle became this the hangout for eventually the Dylan Van Ronk crowd, and as it became it went from a sense of camaraderie as Dylan got bigger and bigger and went to 64 and 65, and he's, you know, suddenly having hit singles and stuff. I think things got a little bit more tense, and it became somewhat fraught from what everyone promised me. You know, Dylan, Bobby Neuwirth would show up, or David Ballew.
Right.
That was his little posse.
Eric
They'd make a
Anderson.
table. Then you'd have Phil Oakes and Eric Anderson and Tom Paxton and whoever kind of around them at other tables. And Dylan would be like, yeah, Al Kooper might be there, as he told me. You know, and you know, Dylan would kind of zero in on somebody and Neuwirth and start picking them apart and kind of taunting them a bit, you know, and they would squabble over, you know, what words one or another could use in a song. And there was all kinds of competitive friction, but at the same time, it was also it. I think one of the great things about the Village is the way that it despite in that kind of atmosphere, it encouraged so much songwriting. You know, and
Right.
Joni Mitchell was only there for, I don't know, about a year in 1967, and she wrote like 60 songs. That was like
Wow.
up to that point, it was the most songs she'd ever written in her life. And the
Good.
same extended to the Dylan and Phil Oakes crowd. You know, they would kind of prod each other and so forth, but then they'd be like, well, I'm gonna show you. Here's, you know, Dylan playing Mr. Tambourine Man for Phil Oakes and David Ballew, just like, oh, let me play this thing I just wrote, and their jaws drop, you know. And so it was, you know, I think Dylan was also, he was a positive disruptor, I would say. And this, I was reminded of this in talking to people who were around him, of the way he encouraged songwriting.
Right.
He arrives in 61, and suddenly in the middle of 62, he's playing this thing called Blowing in the Wind. And then soon after that, Hard Rain. People again, their jaws are dropping, like, wait,
Which,
where did this come from?
yeah, well, that was a cool. I love the little trivia that he was a roommate with Wavy Gravy, right? Correct, and that's where he was banging out. We have it up here. I'm in West Saugerties. I'm actually right down the road for like a quarter of a mile from Big Pink, and. You know, Dylan was banging out songs same way at the Cafe Espresso on the upstairs there.
Wow. Yeah. I
So
hope somebody
then,
has. I hope somebody has all these typewriters somewhere. They're probably long gone and trashed. But
well,
do we need them?
there is one at the Bearsville Center. They have a little room that is sort of a mock-up of like Dylan's place because the woman who bought the Bearsville Center also bought Cafe Espresso. What used to be Cafe Espresso, which was then the photo museum place, but she does have. I don't know if it's a real Dylan typewriter. It might be just some old Olivetti. But
Right,
then
right.
th through Dylan, everything goes electric. So let's talk about that. So there's, you know, another guy who I see all the time getting coffee up here, John Sebastian, Lovin' Spoonful.
Right.
So when did it go from folk to electric, and what happened to the Fokers.
Yeah, it was really, it's funny. We all think Dylan going electric in Newport summer 65 was kind of where it started, but you know, I was kind of reminded in my research that the Village and Dylan were all starting to go electric kind of like right around the same time. It was really fascinating. They were, you know, I don't know about Dylan, but so many of them, of course, were impacted by the Beatles and Ed Sullivan and Hard Day's Night. And suddenly by like late 64, January 65, you have, you know, the origins of the Spoonful and John and Sal and those guys putting together that band, playing their first gigs at the Night Owl, which had been a bowling alley and was now like a quote unquote rock and roll club. You had the very early gigs of the Blues Project. You had again Danny Kalb,
Right.
fierce blues purist, acoustic musician. He hears Tim Hardin at the Night Owl, as Danny told me before he passed, and you know, here's Tim Hardin playing electric guitar and playing blues. Like, my God, this is a whole new thing. The same month, January 65, Dylan's recording, you know, Bringing It All Back Home. You know, it's fascinating. Like that month, I don't know what was in the water in the village, but suddenly everybody decided that, folk had sort of run its course in a way. It had gotten too commercial. We had like the rooftop singers and all that stuff by then. It,
Right.
you know, it had become poppy. Rock and roll was suddenly the uncharted territory. Same time around these guys, a little later, Jesse Colin Young, again, a village guy playing the folk clubs, playing the basket houses.
Yeah, I didn't realize he came from Queens. We were stunned. He's
Yeah.
we were st I mean, I'm from Flushing, New York, but I mean born there.
Wow.
But yeah, it was like stunning. We were like, oh, wasn't he from like West Virginia or California? But
Yeah.
no.
No, he's Queens kid. Yeah, Perry Miller. And he's up in Boston briefly and meets what becomes the Youngbloods. They come back down to the city. Now he's an electric musician. And I think it was just, yeah, it was it had both I think a good and negative effect ultimately on the scene, because certainly, I mean, so much great music came from that we still
Right.
play to this day, whether it's all the Spoonful songs and certainly, and Dylan and the Blues Project. But it also kind of at the same time planted the seeds for the first kind of collapse of the village in a way, because suddenly with the rock and roll bands, you had more people. You had more tourists coming in. You had drug dealers coming in.
Right.
There was a big bust, in the summer of '66, with heroin dealers nabbed, because they knew there were teenagers in the village. They wanted to sell them drugs. The village started being overrun, and it definitely impacted a group like the Blues Project, because they were
Yeah,
kind of,
definitely.
caught between Danny's, purism
Yeah.
and Cooper wanting them to be more commercial. The Blues Project is another group I focus on, the group for that reason. I think they came to embody the conflicts within the village itself by then. Like,
Right.
okay, stay pure and acoustic, or do you quote unquote sell out and go electric and have hit singles? And even Van Ronk had an electric band.
Right.
So, and so by 67-ish, suddenly, so many of the icons we just talked about earlier, Dylan, Oakes, et cetera, they're gone.
Right.
You have the Blues Project breaking up. You have the Spoonful breakup as a result of a drug bust
Right.
from a couple of its members. The Youngbloods, as Jesse Colin Young told me, were like, they just got tired of New York City and they went to California and said, wow, we love this. They move. So, it seemed like within no time at all, it became this bustling electric scene, and then it was over in like 2 years.
Well, another scene that you touch on, not as deeply as folk, is the history of jazz in the village. And
Right.
there's a sort of a fascinating history of it, which I didn't realize, the pre-jazz history of the village vanguard, if you could kind of go into that, and then
Yeah,
really it
yeah.
as the iconic sort of stage for the classic live recordings of Bill Evans and Coltrane and Sonny
Yeah,
Rollins.
yeah. The Vanguard, the village music scene, it's hard to say where it exactly started. There were certainly lots of classical concerts in Washington Square Park in the 1800s, but I think you could probably start it in the mid 30s when the Village Vanguard opened, along with a club called the Cafe Society, which was in
Right.
Sheridan Square, and that was where people like Billie Holiday had some of her early gigs and sang Strange Fruit there famously, and outraged many people in the audience who weren't expecting to hear, such a startling song. And the Vanguard opened in 35 by Max Gordon, who had come to the city for law school. And like so many, like somebody, the guy who started the Gaslight was a car salesman, and just comes into the village and says, wow, this is be kind of cool to open a club here. The days when you could just do that.
Yeah.
And the same with the Vanguard. And right from the beginning, the Vanguard, as well as Cafe Society, kind of set the tone for frankly, the kind of progressive attitudes of the village. The Vanguard early on had people like Leadbelly. It had some of the early kind of a group called the Reviewers, who were a satirical political comedy act, who
Okay.
would take pot shots at the politics. Then in the 40s, you had the Weavers, who kind of made their name, the Vanguard. They got their record deal playing down there, and suddenly became, the biggest thing in, commercial folk music ever. And so, and that was all in the, this pie-shaped room in the basement of Sheridan Square, in the Sheridan Square area, where the Village Vanguard was. And yeah, the Vanguard, and then of course later on, pivotal year of 1957, as I write in the book, one of the things that happens that year is the Vanguard goes to all jazz.
Right.
They had had folk and sort of vaudeville and Professor Irwin Corey and all this kind of wide-ranging stuff. And then
Who
and
lived
57.
on Sniffin' Court, by the way,
Oh wow.
which is on the The Doors album cover.
Okay.
Yeah, and just
Oh
a
wow.
little
I
more
didn't know
trivia.
that. That's cool.
Sorry, but go
So
ahead.
yeah,
I mean.
in 57, the Vanguard goes to all jazz, and that's right when Sonny Rollins is booked early
Right.
on, does the famous Vanguard Live album there, which helps put the club on the map, has the album, the club title and the club name and the
Right.
title of the album really helps. And then soon after that, you have Coltrane, and then you have free jazz starting at the five spot in the East Village, right at
Right.
the border of the East and West Village. At the same time, so at the same time that you have, roughly the same time you have people like Dylan kind of pushing the envelope and saying, "Hey,
Right.
I'm gonna go down to the Gaslight and sing a 7-minute song called Hard Rains Are Gonna Fall."
Right.
Just before that, you have Ornette Coleman and Coltrane saying, "You know what? We're tired of where jazz is going. We want to like take it to the outer
Right.
limits, and the
And then
Village was suitable for that."
later on you get the Village Gate, and then even further down the road you get really the sort of New York 70s, 80s jazz scene coalesces around 7th Avenue South, and that was the Brecker Brothers Club, right?
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating the way the Village would mirror the changes in music in some ways. Folk was the huge thing in the late 50s, early 60s, and then you had all those clubs. And even with jazz, I'm glad you brought that up because, I mean, 7th Avenue South, along there were a whole new bunch of jazz clubs in the 70s, but 7th Avenue South was started by the Brecker Brothers, and it was basically, kind of a well, entirely, but a lot of the music played there was fusion, which of
Right,
course
totally.
was the thing in the 70s.
Right.
And you'd have these extended jam sessions and with all those musicians, with the Breckers and Don Grolnick and Jaco Pastorius would drop in, and it became this hub for a new kind of music that was very New York in a way, and somewhat Village. And it was almost like the Village kind of rolling with the times in a way. It didn't get stuck in one genre, the way it didn't get stuck in just folk and you and went to kind of electric rock and roll.
Yeah, well, then you also touch on punk when you talk about the ill-fated Mercer Arts Center and the Dolls and that whole scene. So let's hear a little bit about how that came in. And that was the dark days, correct? That was the darkest days there.
The early 70s was a pretty down period for the Village. By then you had many of the original clubs like the Gaslight and the Cafe Agogo all gone. Folk City had to was kicked out of its space and moved into a new location on Third Street. The Cafe Wa shut down. That's where Dylan did his first, supposedly his first gig.
Really?
So when he first, he sat in with Fred Neil and Karen Dahl. There's that famous photograph of the three of them. That might be, I don't know if it's that night, but he went there right away. And the Mercer Arts Center was kind of really, really interesting, the way in which like jazz musicians started to feel in the 60s that they were being pushed out of the scene, and that's why they went west. That's why all those clubs like 7th Avenue South, the Vanguard's still there, Sweet
Sweet
Basil,
Basil,
all
yeah.
those places were all like West Village, right? And
Right.
then rock and roll started to kind of be slowly moved east. It was hard to kind of I think that having the Fillmore East open east in the East Village in 68 was a big reason for that, because suddenly bands could play there. But the Mercer Arts Center, which was kind of a such an interesting compound, it was like this multi-roomed smorgasbord venue where it had all these little hallways and little rooms where they had theater productions, like one of the first productions of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, for example. And then they had a couple of rooms for music, and that's where the New York Dolls really kind of made their name. And they embodied a certain, the
I like that word. Did you come up with that, the bridge and tunnel Rolling Stones?
I guess I did. Maybe
That was
I
good. I wrote a print review, which I'm going to put in this too, of the book, and that struck me. That was a great line.
Oh, thanks. They kind of were, and even the way they dressed, kind of in drag and stuff was the village kind of, they were not gay, but they expressed the sort of like more liberated lifestyle the village was starting to represent. But it was by then the Mercer Arts Center was like the last stand for rock and roll, like because all the other clubs were gone, and you had this place right on the border of the village on Broadway. And then of course there's this collapse of the part of the hotel that's part of that the
Right.
club was attached to, and suddenly the last vestige of a rock scene in the village 1973 is literally gone almost. So
Yeah.
that's and it's funny, like 6 months later or so is when CBGB's opens. So
Right.
like the scene goes from Bleecker and Bleecker Street when you have some rock bands, then it starts going to goes to Mercer. Oh no, we can't play there anymore. It's like, well, let's keep going east. And
Right.
then suddenly you have CB's and Hurrah's and that whole East Village scene. So it was this migration of rock and roll,
Yeah, and
over
then
to over out of the village.
you kind of close up with the sort of the revitalization of sort of the scene as far as singer-songwriters go. So that was the era. I had never heard of the Speakeasy, and I used to go out all the time, and I actually used to work at Bigelow Pharmacy. I was a stockwell. I don't know if you know that, 6th Avenue and 8th Street, Bigelow
Okay.
Pharmacy, and
Wow.
I used to
Right
deliver.
near the Brentano's bookstore or whatever it was called.
Yeah, I used to deliver
Barnes and Noble.
necessary vitamins, let's say, to Electric Lady Studios, which was around the corner. People would,
Yes.
call in
Oh,
and
wow. Right.
but at any rate,
Actual vitamins? Actual
not
vitamins, huh?
really. That's I'm being facetious, or I don't know what I'm coming, but the things to give them more energy, let's say.
There you go. Okay.
So you talk about this, so the scene gets revitalized around, and Dave Von Ranke is still there. So this is with the Cornelia Street Cafe and the Speakeasy, and you say like Forbrit and Suzanne Vega, and so it's
Yeah,
talking a little bit about that.
a whole new kind of crop of singer-songwriters start arriving in like starting 75, 76. Jack Hardy is who had a whole colorful past of
Right.
his own is there as one of the kind of leaders of it. And Forbird and the Roach Sisters, and then eventually, Suzanne Vega and people like Frank Christian, David Massengill. And they're still drawn. I mean, some of those people have passed away, but I was able to speak to a bunch of those folks, and I said, "Why would you come to the village in 1976 when the storyline, the media narrative was it was over and every only it was all about CBGBs and East?" And they were like, "No, there was still that allure, that and that lure of playing one of those places, playing your new songs, having some record company person hear you and sign you. Even in the dark days, that mythology of the village, was still there. And
Right.
so you have this whole new crop of people coming up. Some of them help transform a little coffee house on Cornelia Street into a weekly songwriters thing. Folk City gets revitalized with new owners who start booking all these people. And yeah, the Speakeasy, which was the strangest room. I mean, I was there a number of times, and it was in the back of a falafel restaurant. You walk in, and it's like there's the spinning meat thing, and some tables and chairs. And in the back, you step down this little performance space, with like a little stage with like a wrought iron railing and
Wow.
a fish tank, a wall-to-wall fish tank behind the stage. It was kind of the oddest place, but it became this sort of home for a lot of the singer-songwriters like Hardy and Vega and many others to again ply their craft, and they ran it themselves,
And they
and more
did
importantly,
it.
they started putting out records too, monthly.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I was going to get to. Yeah.
I mean, they were sort of a pioneering DIY, because the record
Right.
business by 1981 or two could care less about that style of music. And so they were like, well, let's just do it ourselves. So they started these things that came to be called the Fast Folk Records. Every month they would put out a new record of a dozen or so songs from all those people, recorded in Brooklyn and in the home studio of one of the musicians' parents' house, you know,
Right.
and they would press it themselves and put it out and sell it. And it was kind of like, the world might be ignoring us, but we exist. And a lot of great songs came out. I mean,
Yeah.
Thomas Diner by Suzanne Vega
Yeah.
is probably the most enduring. I don't know if anybody would have guessed that back in 1982 or three or so when she started singing it, but it's been sampled like crazy. And I just heard a Latin hip hop record came out this summer by Mike Towers that samples Tom's Diner. You
Wow.
know, that's become the song that has lasted, in some ways from that scene. But yes, it was a whole new thing, a whole new kind of rebirth. Kenny's Castaways, is often written out of the history books, but that's
Right.
where Forbert and the Roaches, Willie Nile, Carolyn Moss, another one, that's where they all got seen by the Clive Davises of the world and got reviewed by the Times people. The John
Yeah.
Mockworth would go write
Yeah.
reviews and they get record deals out of them. So
Yeah. Well,
it was a nice second wind that they had there.
we got about 2 more minutes left, so let's talk about those evil real estate gents and how they screwed everything up. So real estate comes in and what happened?
It really does.
Except for Dave. Dave had a rent
Except for
control,
Dave.
but yeah.
Dave got a rent control place on Sheridan Square in 1970-ish, and he kind of lucked out. But yeah, I mean, especially that became the fall of the scene in so many ways in the 80s. I mean, real estate was always an issue, and into the 70s, but rents start getting, the West Village in the 80s suddenly becomes even hotter as a commercial property. Suddenly people are paying, six figures for co-op apartments and things
Right.
like that. I was living in that area at the time, renting.
Right.
You kind of started seeing that around you, and yeah, suddenly like Folk City, which was a historic place, suddenly has its rent jacked up three times more than it was. The same with the Lone Star Cafe in
Right.
the this is all like in the mid 80s. The rents get renewed at multiple times what they were, and people can't afford it anymore. And that also happened with the Bottom Line, which we haven't
Right.
talked about, but that was a club that completely revitalized the
Right.
Village in the mid 70s, and suddenly by the early 2000s, they're behind in their rent payments, and NYU runs it, and they're like, "Well, sorry, Charlie, you were taking over."
Yeah.
So
Well,
it was. I really see the Village story, the Village Music story, as a metaphor for so many things about the changes in the city, and about the rise and fall, I think, of Bohemian culture.
yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's a great book called Talking Greenwich Village, and go read it and then do a lot of listening. Thank you for your time, David.
Thank you, Sal. It's great being here.
Ciao.
Just like
So twice on a wire, on a wire, wire.